Hello, thank you. Hello, strangers. We haven't had blue drums for a while. Thank you all for coming. I want to thank our speakers, Mike Coloni and Rebecca Kiro, for letting us on Chapter 13 Attorney Speech Issues. I know those are issues near and dear to everybody's hearts. I want to tell you about what we've got coming up. October 11th, we have the judges, myself and Judge Helfinger and Judge Hannon, will give you an update on where we are with the local rules update in the Eastern District, as well as discuss best practices. This is your chance to say, hey, I really wish you would maybe consider this procedure, or, you know, I've seen this procedure done by another judge or in another court. It really seems to work well. What do we think about that? So please come, and as a special incentive, the Eastern District of Wisconsin Bar Association is going to provide an actual breakfast for the Lou Jones breakfast. Coffee, donuts, and all we have to do is listen to a little spiel about what a great organization they are. And they are a great organization. So please come next month, October 11th. Now, in November, we have our traditional Supreme Court cases they've decided this term, and that what's upcoming for next term. We don't have as many this year as last year, but we're still going to stick with that program. We are going to change it to November 1st. I guess there's an election coming up, and that would be on that second Tuesday, so that's what I've heard anyway. I'm not really sure. November 1st, our traditional speakers, Pete Blaine and Tom Schreiner, will be coming in on that Supreme Court. Then December 13th, again, our standard traditional thing, ethics with Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer. That's going to be great, and we'll have Paula's cookies. Again, additional incentive, please come and you get your free ethics credit. So today, again, I want to thank our speakers, and I also want to really encourage you to come on back in November, December, January. We have a tax topic in the works, so we'll keep you posted on that. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. We were asked to discuss attorney's fees and fee applications, and Mike and I spent two of our 3 years of law school together bickering over just about everything you can think of in the SBA office, so I figured he was a good partner for this. So the first thing that we wanted to talk about a little bit is Section 329, and what does in contemplation of or in connection with the case mean? Mike, what does it mean to you?
I have no idea. I don't think I've ever really known what it means. We looked at it. I mean, I still don't know what it means, even after preparing for this thing. I mean, it's one of those things where I kind of try to err on the side of disclosure. I mean, first of all, why is it important? 329 is the section that requires you to disclose any fees you earn. It also gives the bankruptcy court really broad latitude to determine what your fees are, and possibly if you took too much money, take the money back from you and give it to either the estate or the debtor or whoever paid it to you. There are also cases out there that say that if you don't disclose your fee, that it's per se unreasonable. So disclosing fees is really, really important because you might lose the entire point of you doing all this work. In contemplation or in connection to a case is one of those things that we've looked at, and I still don't know what it means. Because when a debtor's in bankruptcy, especially Chapter 13, their whole life is kind of in connection to or related to their bankruptcy. So does the PI attorney have to file this statement? Does any attorney they use for anything who takes a fee have to take that? You found some...
I did find a couple of cases. There was one out of Vermont in 2002 that's in the materials that talked about the fact that in contemplation of and in connection with are two different concepts. That in contemplation of is more of a subjective test. And basically the court referred to if the retainer letter has the word bankruptcy in it, or if the invoices refer to bankruptcy, that is going to be considered in contemplation of bankruptcy. that in connection with was supposedly more of an objective standard. I honestly didn't see too much of a difference in looking at the two. But basically, do the services have an impact on the bankruptcy case?
And I think that's where I always got stuck. Everything has an impact on the bankruptcy case. I mean, especially if you're going to be getting money for the debtor. I mean, the two examples that popped in my head were my firm did a class action about medical proof of claims. It was directly about a proof of claim, but it was a 100% state court cause of action. There was no bankruptcy court action. I mean, we filed it in bankruptcy court because we thought it encompassed jurisdictional issues. Mm-hmm. But in theory, that case, in my mind, didn't really have anything there. Now, my basic viewpoint is you can't ever get in trouble when you disclose stuff, so just keep disclosing stuff. But it becomes an issue. The other thing that the other example I thought of was Fair Debt Collection Practices type cases. You file an FDCPA type case. Is that in connection with the bankruptcy or not? I don't know. I mean, it definitely has to do with the debtor's relationship with their creditors.
Well, and I did find one case that talked about a situation where kind of the opposite, that is something that was actually not in connection with or contemplation of, and that was in a case that we'll actually talk about a second time in a little bit more detail, but there was an adversary in this In re Pazzanello's case. The adversary action was the debtor attempting to get attorney's fees back from the prior attorney from a prior case. And that prior attorney brought up in the adversary, well, hey, wait a minute, the current attorney, his attorney's fees are too high, his attorney's fees need to be looked at, so on and so forth. And the court determined that the prior attorney had no direct legal interest in the bankruptcy and wasn't a party in interest that was able to raise 329. Do you want to talk a little bit about the seven stuff?
I mean, sure. We'll just move on because we still don't have any definition of what that is.
Unless anybody's got questions.
Go for it.
So divorce attorneys, we often have a divorce attorney representing the debtor pre-petition, and then maybe issues come up in family court post-petition. What steps do we take to protect that divorce attorney and their fees?
I mean, in theory, if they want to be 100% safe, disclose stuff. I mean, 329 basically is a disclosure issue. I mean, as long as you're reasonable, which I think we're all bound to be by our ethical rules anyways, you disclose it to the bankruptcy court and you're okay. That's a perfect example as well. I mean, you're dealing with who owes debt and it involves bankruptcy. I don't think it's in, I mean, my personal viewpoint on it, I don't think that counts as in connection to or related to the bankruptcy. It's a state court matter. It's outside of it. But like I said, it's one of those things where I don't really want to tell someone not to do it because then if I'm wrong, they're going to come after me on it.
What's the downside of telling them to disclose what the fees were?
No.
Is there one? Then you should just tell them to do it. I mean, it's not like you have to tell, you have to put like a fee application in or anything. You just have to disclose.
They got to file a rule. They got to file a 2016
right.
form.
This is what I got paid, and this is who paid it. This, generally, the services were related to a divorce. I mean, if the.
Now, as a practical nature, I don't think anyone actually files those statements.
Okay.
So. I mean, have you ever seen? I mean, has anyone ever seen another lawyer file besides the actual debtor in the debtor's attorney in the bankruptcy file a 2016 form? Right. So, I mean, I'd tell them if they asked me, but a lot of times they don't ask me. And I mean, I think a lot of attorneys, especially ones that don't practice bankruptcy law, and actually, especially divorce attorneys, don't really understand bankruptcy at all. Probably don't even know that this is here. You know, so, I mean, but yeah, is that in connection? I don't know if it is. You can make the argument it is. You can make the argument that it isn't.
Well, for instance, if the court determines that being from determining whether a claim was a domestic support obligation or not, send it back to family court, then does the bankruptcy attorney chase that case back to family court? No, you probably want the family law attorney to continue to represent their client back to family court post-petition on that issue. But in a recent conversation, just in the last couple of weeks, the family law attorney who referred the case to me in the first instance said, well, okay, so what happens to the fees that I was owed before this case was filed? And I had to explain about what pre-petition claims are and so forth and how they're treated. And he said, so you want me to do work for him post-petition. What happens if he converts his case to Chapter 7? And I had to explain to him that
he's not getting paid there either.
Subject to review, but in the Chapter 7 case, unless it was an asset case, he probably wasn't going to get paid. And that's the way our world is. And he said, you guys are crazy. And no, he wouldn't have anything to do with the case and wouldn't continue to represent the debtor. So, it's just a question. It's just very recent.
And I don't think we have an answer. I think right now it doesn't come up because nobody's snooping around and looking at it. I mean, I guess the reason they don't file it is because nobody's brought it as an issue in front of the court. Hey, this guy didn't disclose his fees. I mean, they might be able to get around the per se unreasonableness given the fact that they didn't have any idea what they were supposed to be doing. But realistically speaking, I mean, there probably should be a lot more 2016s filed around these type of cases. The mediation or the modifications that a lot of attorneys are doing for mortgages aren't necessarily around as much as they used to be right now. But when that was in its heyday, there were a lot of attorneys doing work for clients that I don't know if they ever filed anything with the court. So, moving on, we're going to talk about unbundling of legal fees, okay? Unbundling of legal fees is when you agree with your client that you're going to provide a very limited scope of representation, meaning you are not going to represent them fully through their entire case. Either you're going to help them with a very limited thing, provide them advice on how to do something themselves, something along that ways. The ethical considerations of unbundling legal fees is that you need to have informed consent from your client, okay? Meaning that they have to know that you're not representing them and that they have to actually understand that they're not representing them completely through the entire thing. Where this gets interesting in my mind when I was thinking about this and we were preparing for it is I know a lot of attorneys don't take 100% of their Chapter 7 fees before they file the Chapter 7. And the way they do that is they say we have a contract for me to provide X services before we file, and then we have a contract for me to provide X services that we sign after we file to do the post-petition work. In theory, the only way you could do that is if you're unbundling your legal fees, okay? The question that we've had, and this is a question that's actually been pretty popular around the country, is can you really unbundle legal fees in a bankruptcy? Can you agree with the debtor, I'm going to file your petition? That's it. Not going to go to the 341, not going to complete the schedules, not going to do anything, or are you going to run afoul the judges first, but more importantly, ethical and other considerations, because can a debtor really consent to that when I don't know if they actually understand what's happening here? I don't know. I personally, my office doesn't do the some money before you file and some money after you file. We try to avoid it because I don't think you can really. I mean, we had this come up in the local rules committee on what does the fee include. A lot of districts have an unbundling of fee rule in their local rules, which basically just says you, if by filing this case, you agree to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And anything above that, then you can have a separate retainer for, but by agreeing to these. This is one of the reasons why in Minnesota, which is like the big place for taking fees before filing and taking fees after filing in Chapter 7 bankruptcy. In Minnesota, they have an unbundling rule and they've used that to prevent basically anyone from ever taking any attorney's fees after you file. You can't separate it into pre-petition and post-petition work and get paid pre-petition for pre-petition work and post-petition for post-petition work. We don't have a rule that requires you to, you know, file the schedules, provide the documents to the trustee, go to the 341, you know, appear at, you know, whatever. You know, reaffirmation agreements, etc. But I think that's one of the areas that's a little bit up in the air in this district. I don't think it's really come up yet, but I don't know how, I see a lot of sevens, and a lot of people are filing those cases with a pre-filing amount and a post-filing amount. So, I mean, I don't know, I know how they're doing it, I just don't know what they're doing to get around the potential ethical and other conflicts.
Well, and one of the things that I did when we started doing the research for this presentation is I sent out an email to all of the staff attorneys across the country just asking, what's your standard no-look fee for a Chapter 13? And I can tell you that, for example, the I think it's the Western Division of Texas, Austin Division, they sent me their website. They sent me the link because it's so complicated that it wasn't explainable. And they went through a couple of the things that they do, but it's like, well, you get $250 for this and $300 for this, and it's completely piecemeal that you pick out what things you did, and that's how you add up your fee. You know, there are other places that, I mean, there's one, the Northern District of Alabama, their no-look fee is $3,000, but if everything's done at that first confirmation hearing, the judge will tack on an extra $250 for doing it right the first time. So, I mean, it's even with 13s, within the rules for...
It doesn't happen that often, so quick.
It's like construction work. Is there a delay penalty, too?
I didn't see a delay penalty in anybody's, but...
Oh, you're penalized if you're delayed.
I know your money's not that high right now.
Oh, not economically. Yeah, I mean, I'm in a lot of districts now, and they're very different. Everybody's very, very different in terms of how they handle fees. What we looked at in the outline when we were talking about it is whether or not it's a flat fee or whether it's a no-look fee, and what's more common. A flat fee is basically just where you agree to do however much work it takes for this amount of dollars. Whether it's too little or too much, it doesn't matter. This is what I'm charging you, and that's what it is. The other option is the no-look fee, which means you just put that amount of money in, and as long as it's that amount of money, nobody's going to look at it.
I'm not sure that's right. You don't have to do a fee application.
You don't have to do a fee
to get that. Somebody can certainly look at it.
Well, and someone can, yes, and someone could object, obviously,
right,
to
right,
that no-look
right,
fee.
Right,
if it's in the,
right, you got $3,500 up front, and the case didn't make it to the 341 because of some problem. Somebody could certainly look at that and say, ooh, I don't know.
Right.
That's reasonable. But you don't have to file a fee application to get that amount of money. That's what the no-look fee is, in my mind.
Well, and then the flat fee, I mean, it's a presumed reasonable fee. If something, you know, explodes in a case and you have a bunch more work than what you were expecting, and it's not in the ordinary course of what a normal Chapter 13 would be, I got the impression from case law that you could still do a fee application above and beyond
not
that.
Not if it's a flat fee. If it's a no-look fee, you certainly can. If it's a straight flat fee, and that's actually what's in the Eastern District of Missouri, you get a choice. You can do fee applications or you can do the straight flat fee. It doesn't matter what you do in the case.
Okay.
You're getting $4,000 and that's it. You can... Debtor can call you every single day for the next 5 years and talk to you for a half hour. You're getting $4,000. That's it.
So the expectation is that that balances out, though, in the case where they don't call you and they just pay and it's done. Correct?
Sure.
Well, it could happen.
It does.
And theoretically, subject to all the caveats you've already gone over, you could have a flat fee for unbundled services.
You could have a flat fee for unbundled services as well. Right. And that becomes the question, really. What we looked at, the no-look fee in the Seventh Circuit, two cases that I had, and this is back in 05, regarding the no-look fee, were very early on cases of the attorney fee-only cases. Judge Pepper had two decisions. They're basically identical. They just have different names on the top of them. But she did a really good job of laying out exactly where our fee came from and what she thought it was. What she maintained was that the 35, and it was 2,500 at the time, was a no-look fee for basically providing cradle-to-grave representation of the debtor through a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. So you were basically agreeing to be the debtor's attorney for bankruptcy, not adversary proceedings and other, from the beginning of the case until the end of the case. You couldn't drop out or whatever after the 341 or say after confirmation, I'm not talking to the debtor anymore. It was for being the attorney the whole way through. The case that she got the idea from or that she was looking at was in the matter of Geraci, which was a Seventh Circuit court case where Peter Francis Geraci was actually challenging a cap on Chapter 7 fees, and the Seventh Circuit went through and looked at how fees worked and no-look fees worked specifically. The other thing she cited in that case was Colliers, where Colliers basically said a lot of courts, to save themselves time and attorneys' time, say this is what we think the cases cost in our district. Bring us the ones that you don't necessarily agree fit with these, but rather than spending time on every single case trying to figure out how much this case is going to be, here's where we're not going to look at it unless someone brings it to us. And, you know, if you do more than that amount, you can ask for more money.
Nothing.
Okay. So that brings us to the next session where, okay, now I did more work than the $3,500. How do I get more money than the $3,500? We've had some long discussions about this in the local rules committee, and there may be something coming out of that committee, either in terms of a form or in terms of more guidance on what this stuff all means. But the way that I always viewed it is, the $3,500 right now is what you're anticipating the case to cost. If you go through a case and you've done more work than the $3,500, you can submit an application to the court asking for additional fees. In order to ask for additional fees above the $3,500, I think that you have to prove that you did the $3,500 worth of work first. You can't just file an application that says, hey, look, I had two motions to dismiss, give me a grant. Because you may have had two motions to dismiss, but you might have had the easiest debtor on earth who never talked to you at all, and you got confirmed in the first crack, and you didn't do $3,500 worth of work yet.
How can you use that example, and I can't? The one where you don't have to talk to the debtor.
So, I mean, from my standpoint, as I look at it, I think if you show that you did the first $3,500 worth of work and then you're still over the top of that number, the way we look at it in our office is we always try to look and see if there are more concrete things to point to as well. You know, motion for relief, AOD, motion to dismiss, another AOD. Things like that, so you can lay out in your application, these are the things that we didn't expect to happen if a normal case went all the way through, and that's what's causing this problem. You look at fee apps.
We do look at fee apps, and I did go back and just kind of did a search for the last 6 months in the Seventh Circuit, what kinds of things were coming up when it came to attorney fees and fees in general. One of the things that I found several cases on was the idea of lumping, where instead of when you're billing, taking a bunch of things that you've done and lumping them together to get that tenth of an hour so that you can charge for it. And the court has a problem with that.
Do you really need to lump stuff together to get to a tenth of an hour?
Apparently, some people do.
Yeah, I mean, the way I always viewed it is that when I read those cases, what I thought they were doing is they were saying, I did this, this, and this 5 hours. You know, and just saying, preparation for 341, 3 hours. What's that mean? Well, I did this and this and this. And they're like, no, break it out. Because, I mean, I know I have a program. I'm assuming most everybody else who does a FIAP has a program where you just do, or any lawyer for that matter probably has a billing program where you do Lodestar and you just sit there and you say, you know, attended 341.5, you know, and, you know, preparation for blah, 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 0.2, and you just keep writing down everything you do from the moment the case starts until whenever you're asking for your fees. What I read when I read the lumping cases is I thought that guys were just taking a whole bunch of stuff, putting in one paragraph, and going, look, I did 14 hours worth of work. And it's like, well, did you? You know, because I would think, if it's all lumped together like that, my thought process is, if I were looking at it, is I'm like, I mean, you got to view it almost like if you were getting this bill yourself.
Right.
What did you do?
Well, and the one that struck me, though, was the one where it, the amount of time and the money that was allotted to preparing the application was almost 10% of the total application. I mean, if you're doing it as you go along, and you've got a computer program that does it, is it really going to take you that long to prepare that?
I mean, I don't know how much that was for. I mean, maybe the guy was adding
$1,000.
Okay, well, then that's 10% a lot. $3,000 to prepare a bill is a lot. I mean, but I mean, putting a little bit of money for preparation of the application when you're doing the fee application, in my mind, has always been okay. I know we do it. My theory on it, though, too, and the thing you have to consider when you're doing these fee applications is, so you did your case, you get your 4 years in or whatever, you figure out I'm short, so you go in, you ask for more money, they give you another $1,500. You still got a year left of case. That's all free, unless you do another application in month 60. You can't possibly get paid and for all the work you've done already until the last day, in theory, but you can't file a fee application the last day, or you're not getting paid that money because you're getting paid through the plan. So my idea, my thought had always been, if I wind up doing that, I mean, my preparation in my mind also covers the fact that I'm probably not going to get paid anything else. Now, God willing, I have everything fixed and they just need to make 10 more payments and everything will get paid off by the end of the case. It doesn't always happen. Putting in a fee application, I know this for a fact, I don't believe you can file a fee application within 6 months of having filed a previous fee application. So you get stuck on a time frame there too, where you can't come back in and ask for money again in the rules.
I
have no
idea,
but I know that's
3 months, but it can be waived, yeah.
Sorry, I knew it was there. I'd say 6 months. So if it's 3 months, things could blow up. The other issue you potentially have is the cases that you're getting the higher fees in usually are train wrecks for a reason, and getting the money from people who don't have money clearly because they aren't paying their house, aren't paying their bankruptcy, and then going in and saying, hey, give me some more money, doesn't work a lot of times. I mean, I file a lot of fee applications that I don't get a penny on. But I try to avoid doing that because I don't really want to be the straw that breaks the camel's back either. I mean, if you have a client who's just teetering on the edge, yeah, let's increase their plan payment, that'll help. You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into fees, and I mean, the truth of the matter is when you get in one of these bankruptcy cases, there's a lot of ways you're going to do a lot of free work. It's just the nature of the business. But I think that's kind of why we have a presumed reasonable fee, because there are some cases that probably don't total up to $3,500 in fees. You know, the perfect debtor who walks in, makes every payment, they come in month 60 with their credit management certificate, you don't even have to chase them for it, and they come in and you're like, I don't remember you, who are you? You know, but then there are other ones you can dial their phone number without looking it up. You know, so I mean, it is a balance, but that's kind of where we're at. Did you get a consensus on about where people are fee-wise?
Yeah, you know, right around, up and down a little bit, right around $4,000 is usually what I was seeing for a standard 13. For a business case, a little bit more, closer to $5,000 was probably the average. You know, and there are a lot of districts that do the, you know, standard $3,500, $4,000, and then if there's an adversary to strip a junior mortgage, they throw an extra $500 in. Like with our MMM, there's another $500 there.
Yeah, a lot of courts have a a la carte type system. I mean, I guess we kind of have a quasi a la carte system. I mean, you can get extra $500 for the mediation program. In theory, you can file, anytime you file a post-petition amended plan, you could put a slight amount of fees on. I believe it's $300, where the trustees won't object to that, and because it's under the dollar limit, you don't have to file a fee application for it. But there are other districts where it's like, okay, you're getting $3,000 to get the case to confirmation, and then here's your menu. Any of these things happen, tack on more money.
Yeah. There are some places, too, that base it on the amount of plan payments. So if the plan payments are going to total less than $10,000, you get less. If it's going to be more than $10,000, you get more. Just figuring that creates a complexity based on the creditors that you have. Places like New York and New Jersey seem to have skewed the average quite a lot. You know, they're looking at I guess, more complicated cases and higher cost of living and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I was seeing from in the Northeast probably like $10,000 as a pretty standard average.
Well, I'd be interested in what people think. Is our $3,500, we set it way back, I believe, in 05, that's
right.
11 years ago, is it too low? Is it too low? If you say, yeah, it's too low, if we raise it, what impact is that going to have on the debtors? Are we going to have a whole additional subset of pro se Chapter 13 debtors? Because that's not good for anybody. I mean, I know it's not good for me, but I got it. I want you to think about how it's not good for you either, because they clog the system. They make your 341s take longer because the trustees are, you know, trying to explain stuff to them.
I mean, really,
that's my concern in raising it. I'm happy to raise it if you guys tell me, hey, this didn't keep up with the complexity, the cost, everything else. Let's raise it. Tell me that we're not going to now throw a bunch of debtors out there without a lawyer because they can't pay a $4,000 fee or $4,500 fee.
In a 60-month case, it's $8. If it's $4,000, it's $8 difference. I mean, it's $10. I mean, with trustee fees and everything, we're talking about a $10 difference in bankruptcy payments top. And that's assuming you can't take the money away from some other creditor, either through best interest test, etc. So realistically speaking, I mean, it's not, anyone who's impacted by four is impacted by 35. I mean, that's my thought process on it. I have a couple of districts where I practice where we get four. It doesn't really change the math very much. The pro se problem is a pro se problem, but I think a lot of the pro se problem is because realistically they just shouldn't be pro se 13s. They just don't understand how the fees are getting paid over time out of those plan payments. And the actual benefit they derive from having an attorney and a 13 is so greatly outweighed versus the cost. I mean, I think what's the $3,500 over 60 months? It's like $42 or something like that, isn't it? It's like, that's what it boils down to a month over 5 years. So, I mean, I'm always up for a raise, but
what do people think? Because, I mean, that was part of our idea, was to kind of throw out there and get an unofficial poll.
I guess as long as the procedure to ask for additional fees is as reasonable as it is right now, I don't have any objection to starting out with a base fee of $3,500, because that leaves the door open for cases where we do exceed the $3,500 and we can show why and what we did to earn the first $3,500 and
and ask for an additional increase, there's no problem.
But I mean, are you always, well, I mean, you do things slightly differently though, too, Todd, because you get money from your clients. A lot of times your FEOPs ask for money directly after the case is over sometimes as well, don't they?
Well, at the end of the case, we won't put our fees in the plan if it's going to tank the plan.
Right.
Yeah, we'll ask the court for permission to be paid after.
And I think the theory on potentially increasing the presumed reasonable fee is that's not always a luxury that a lot of people have to be able to get money from people later on.
It's not a luxury. It's sometimes we just do it for our clients. We do it because we want the case to be successful, because that's why we're...
Carrie, you do the same thing, don't you? Carrie Michelson does the same thing.
Are you getting paid on those?
You know, probably it ends up being sort of pro bono.
Okay. Well, I mean, and I do it too. I just don't file the FEOP. I mean, we all do a certain amount of pro bono work. I mean, I'm not saying that. I guess my thought on the presumed reasonable fee in theory was that if we increase it, don't we cover some of that pro bono work or not?
Well, but you're talking about fees at the end of the case, Mike.
Yeah.
We come in during the case, we monitor our fees, because everything we do, we record it and track hourly. And when we're more than $500 above wherever we were prior, we consider if it's appropriate to bring the matter to the court on a fee app. And the process that we're following currently is very reasonable. It's not time consuming. We don't add any time for filing or preparing the fee application. And the judges are extremely reasonable on their review of the applications. So I don't see a problem with $3,500 because the door is always open to come in and ask for more money if you follow the rules. So I don't see any need for an increase, because there certainly are cases where we don't exceed the $3,500 that we've asked for in the first instance.
Any other thoughts?
I guess to Todd's point, either the way it is now, or to some extent the sort of menu thing, which strikes me as much more sort of administrative, maybe not, but potentially administratively sort of costly, by which I mean largely for all you guys. It does have the benefit that it's kind of like price discrimination in the metering sense, by which I mean the cases that need to can be gone through with charging less, and maybe can only sort of the person can only pay less, can be done at the lower rate. And to the extent things are more complicated, either by the process we have now or one of these menu processes, then the price goes up because that's because they're demanding more service, right? And so you can sort of capture more people, whereas, and this goes to Mike's point, depends on sort of how big the margin is, how many people are you going to force out. And maybe the margin isn't very many people, and so that's Mike's point. It's like, then you shouldn't sort of do all this like other stuff because it's not worth the administrative cost. It's kind of very hard to tell which of those two things. Because what you want to do is cover the most people, right? I mean, because not only I think from the judge's standpoint, but to the extent that you can get paid a reasonable return at the lower amount for those kind of cases that justify that return without having to lose money sort of in the long run, then you sort of bring those in, whereas if you had the higher rate, those people aren't going to be able to pay that. And but you know, if the market is small, that's not a big deal.
There's a point where if you make the fee too high, you will tank plans,
right?
Because you won't compete with the car notes. You know,
I mean,
at some point their car note, you know, their interest rate and everything else can't fit inside the plan. And I understand that.
But I think you're right. I mean, a lot of the pro se cases are just cases that shouldn't be. The reason they don't have a lawyer is in part because any of you guys would say, you know,
don't
you shouldn't
do this.
Be
don't
in
do this.
This.
Right.
Well, and there are people, there aren't a lot of people, but there are people that charge less than our no-look fee when they've got a case that's simple, that's, you know, not going to cost them that full $3,500.
Well, and you still have your ethical considerations. I don't think you can abdicate those just based on the fact that the judges said there's a no-look fee, therefore I get to charge whatever I want.
Right.
If you're not going to do the work, you don't get to charge the fee. But, I mean, I mean, I have a district where it's $4,000. I don't see a noticeable difference in the numbers when I run the numbers.
Yeah, and that's not surprising.
It's $9. Anyone else have any thoughts on four or leave it?
I have to say, I would be surprised if I went back to all my cases and automobiles, and they never know on any of them. Maybe that's just the nature of the people that walk in my door. I would be surprised if that would be. So I think it should be. And I, like you, I don't think we need those people.
Well, I guess then my...
What do you think?
I think it should be increased. I think the cases that you spend less than $3,500 or $3,500 are few and far between. I think the majority of cases you're spending over that in time. We don't always FIAP all those cases because sometimes that'll tank the plan. If it tanks the plan, I don't need it. But it might help with some of those, it helps offset some of that in those cases when the fee is put in there up front so that even an extra $500 sometimes can take a plan afterwards. It can make it infeasible when you're doing, when you haven't figured it out from the beginning. Whereas if you figure it out from the beginning, like Mike said, it's an extra $10 a month. Most people are fine with that. It's not a deal breaker. It's not a, but once they're in the plan and they've only got 10 months left and their payment would have to go up by $50 a month to cover that extra $500, that can tank, that can raise their ire, their, you know.
If we left it alone, but came up with a form over 3,500 fee application that everybody could, you know, fit into, and, you know, kind of codified or whatever, that $300 for a post-confirmation modification, just, you know, put it in the modification and you get that. Does that help? Is there another thing that's coming up post confirmation that we
could pick up kind
you
of
could
in
pick
an
up
easy way, right?
In an easy way and say another 300, you know, we're doing it already for the plans, modifications.
I think it works for the plans a lot because oftentimes when you're modifying the plan, the fact is you're making up for something that went wrong.
Well, and you're redoing all the math. So sticking the extra $300 in is very simple because you go, here's what your amended plan payment needs to be. Here's the extra $300. It's already in that.
Right.
And that's
it
why
it's so good for a motion
to
dismiss.
And all creditors too.
Well, and right, and we serve it on all creditors as well.
And oftentimes you're putting more money into the plan anyway for through making up tax refunds or something. So if I'm got to put $1,000 into the plan for tax refunds, it doesn't change the math, what the debtor's payment has to be, whether I get $300 of that.
Right, we're taking money out of the pool for unsecured creditors, so it's actually helping them in that way.
They're at least not hurting them. You try to do like well, we'll allow $300 for defending a motion to dismiss or a motion for relief from stay. I mean, that's all well and good. And maybe that all works out fine, but you may not be filing an amended plan with that either.
Right.
Now am I doing 600? So I got to file an amended plan to get my 300?
No. The plan becomes infeasible when you're adding that.
And yeah, I mean.
Okay, it was just a thought. But at least, do you not agree that having a form fee up, we see all kinds of crazy, you know, I'm not being critical, but we do see a large variety of fee apps and
some that are very good though.
Yeah.
I think that would make administration on your end easier.
Right.
I would think if you had a form, it's a lot easier to review
right.
them.
And
much like the plan, model notice.
Yeah. They are going to have an exhibit, which is your time that you've spent. And it's amazing to me. I guess, when I was a lawyer, I didn't have this problem because I just disciplined myself to keep that time on a daily basis, but I had plenty of colleagues that this was like their nemesis. They couldn't frickin' write their time down. Now they're trying to figure out the bill at the end of a month or a billing cycle, and it's a nightmare. So I'm sure that's not just, you know, 10 years or 15 years ago. It's now that people have a problem keeping that, you know, time contemporaneously. We have had cases where your clients come in and object and say, these fees are outrageous. I thought it was supposed to be included, blah, blah, blah. So now we're kind of fly-specking the fee application. And we find, for example, a lawyer says, I billed an hour for a preparation and attending a hearing on this day. Well, I look on that day. There was no hearing. I spent 3 hours
at a hearing on this day. I look, the hearing was taken off because it was settled. So if you're, you know, we will do our best to come up with a good form that you can fill in. Here's my fears, here's my costs, here's where my, what my hourly rate was, et cetera. But you're going to have to put a exhibit, which is your, you know, time and your billing, and it's got to make sense. Right?
I don't think you're going to get rid of the problem of somebody saying they went to a hearing when they didn't with any form. I mean, that's...
Right.
I mean, our time records should show what you did.
Right.
You know, if I attended a hearing, I attended a hearing.
Right.
I mean, that's...
But if you're like trying to recreate what you did in a case when you're putting together the fee app, this is a problem.
Well, yeah, going backwards and trying to recreate things
right.
that you didn't keep track of
right.
when you were doing them.
Right.
Well, sure, but I don't... No form is going to help that.
Right.
That has to be done.
Yeah, I'm just saying the form is only going to go so far.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even worse in bankruptcy though too. I think, and I train a lot of lawyers at my office, and getting them to write down their time is always a hard part because half your job is flat fee Chapter 7 work where it doesn't matter what time you have. And then the other half is Chapter 13 bankruptcy where you should be writing down every single minute of every time you're spending on the case. So it's inherently difficult for some people to do it. Plus, you're writing down time in a lot of cases that you're never going to use it ever either. And that's what I think a lot of lawyers, when they get pinched for time or they're running around, stop writing stuff down. You just have to go almost with a big firm mentality. You got to write down every minute of every day. You just have to, is what being a lawyer kind of is.
Right. But if we will come up with a form fee application. We'll have it codified that you can get $300 for a post confirmation modification. Is it always post confirmation or would it be pre confirmation?
It can only be post, I believe.
It can only be post.
And Carrie's been waving back
Carrie,
for a while.
I'm saying is that I would never use the $300. I never do use the $300 because modifications, especially if they're post and I have 150 creditors, that's a lot of time and a lot of postage. Lots of times I have to have my clients come in and meet with me to discuss it. I have to get new wage statements because I have to do a new budget. $300 just doesn't cover a modification post petition.
Okay. What about raising that to 500? Is that fair? Is it? Could you have it $300?
Is $300 really the amount I would have? I thought I've seen higher than that, but maybe not.
I think $300 is when we say.
$300 is where
we're
not
going
to. I was thinking four. I hear four.
$300. Object to, is that right?
Right.
The trustees don't object.
Yeah,
I don't.
300 is a number that we are okay with. If it were higher than that, I think that's a discussion that, you know, the trustees would have to have to, and I don't know if Mary wants to pipe in.
It depends on the modification. If it's to add a tax refund that the debtor didn't pay in, that's not really worth $400.
Right.
And to go back to our earlier point, which is, have a no-look, whether it's $300, $400, $500, whatever. But $300, and if you think you have more time than that, file a fee application.
And we can
so
do
make
that.
Make a determination when you do the modification.
But not in a form.
Is something I spent a lot of time on? Don't put the $300 in there.
I hate to say it because, you know, everybody likes to get more money, but I think you probably want to err on the side of if you're going to do a no-look modification thing, I don't know that you want to make it $500, $600. You always have the option to do the itemization
right.
if you think
if
that
you have the itemization.
This took more than that.
Right.
You know, some modifications just don't, they're not $500. They're not. Some are, but then again, you can certainly itemize for that kind of thing. I think, I don't know, I'd rather err on the side of if you're going to do a no-look modification thing, you know, maybe it's a little on the light side because
right.
we do have the option.
What about 300 plus costs? And if you have the actual cost of mailing that's $100, you
that,
get to do that.
I think
that's
very reasonable. Right
that would be very reasonable.
Because if you do have 150 creditors,
300
you have
is your fees, and then what are your costs of mailing it and photocopying it?
That would be reasonable.
Do you think, Rebecca?
I can see where that would probably ease a lot of people's minds.
Do you want to set price for paper then, too? Would there be a
cost per, you know what I mean? Because otherwise, I'm buying really nice paper.
Yeah. Are you putting the pages like four on a page? Is this what
both,
I heard?
Both sides.
Both sides, four on a page?
I don't do both sides, but I have done with adding creditors, like Schedule F,
right.
I'll print it off with two pages to a page, or four pages to a page. So that Schedule F, yeah. So you save on paper there.
You still charge the copy cost. I mean, your machine still charges you the same.
Well, what do you guys think? I don't do this anymore. What? How much a page is it?
I don't know.
Postage
is the biggie. You're telling me if there's 100 creditors, what does that cost?
$50.
Nearly $50.
$50.
So what I'm not getting is why have all this administrative overhead rather than just raising the NOLA fee in the first place? If you raise it to $4,000, presumably there's less. Have to file extra things with the court, I have to put them together. It's just that it's kind of assumed that it's included. And then you guys have you look a little closer at the fee applications for the, when you exceed the 4,000 rather than the 3,500. It also prevents all this questions about what's these particular actions worth, what's a fair fee, because then you can just, if you exceed the 4,000, you just do the standard itemization, the cost, and everything's broken down. Sure, you still come up with the form, so it's easier for you guys to review and easier maybe for us to put together. So it's a little bit smoother in operation.
So that's another quote for raising it to four.
Perhaps we should table this and bring it up in the Rules Committee meeting on Chapter 13.
Well, and I think that's part of actually why I wanted to bring it up at least while we were here is kind of it's a little bit broader of an audience and maybe try and pull some people in.
Right.
And obviously the options aren't mutually exclusive, right?
Right.
You could consider raising it to four and having some of these other things too. I mean, because if the margin of people you lose at four is small, then that combined with some other things as opposed to going to some other bigger number.
Right. I want to wrap it up. We're at 9:30.
You're in charge. You're in charge.
Thank you so much. It was a really great discussion. Remember to come back October 11th for the judges, donuts and coffee from the Eastern District. Bar Association, November 1st, that's a date change on the Supreme Court. December 13th, the bankruptcy ethics. Those are our three things. You can get, I'm sorry about the glitch where we lost some of our video audience, but of course you can get the audio on our website, you can get the outline on the website, and we'll get that lacrosse connection hopefully figured out for next time too. Thanks again, see you October 11th.